Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. We've got a great one in store for you this week. With me this week, we have Alan. G'day, Alan. How you doing?
I am in a personal circle of hell right now. For some reason, we record these really early on a Saturday morning, and that is a bad time right now. So yes. Thanks for that, Matt.
Well, it's not my fault you decided to have an adventure with Nugs.
Would you say they're nuggets or nugs?
Nugs. This is the new slang, right?
Yeah, you're keeping down to the youth.
That's probably not going to... I think that's an Australian-only thing, Alan.
It better not be. The nug future is the only future that I want.
I don't think our global listeners know that a nug is a chicken nugget.
Sadness. Liquid sadness, because they're not actually solid. It wasn't solid. It was liquid. Anyway, this is a podcast about video games. Also, I'm going to introduce Matt, because Matt's here as well.
Hi. Apparently, in America, nug is slang for marijuana, so...
I mean, you probably can probably try and eat it if you want.
Okay. All right. Well, on that note, we'll go and get some nugs. And
never again. No more nugs. Nugs are banned. I killed 3 chickens to have 24 nugs last night, and that's pretty much everything over.
Okay. Hatsune Miku, Anime Noguchi Miku feature Hatsune Miku.
Me,
welcome back, everybody. Hope you enjoyed that. All right, so first up this week, we're going to talk about games to films. So obviously, there are a lot of game developers out there, game publishers and film companies that see the potential for crossovers between video games that are popular and films and big budgets and all that kind of jazz. So far as Ubisoft actually set up a film production studio thing, I believe Assassin's Creed was actually produced by Ubisoft, was it not?
I think so, yes.
As much of a train wreck as that was. Yeah. Unfortunately, it was really a pity, actually. I was really looking forward to it because the director is an Aussie guy who I really liked, or really like. Maybe I don't like him so much now, but I really liked him when he did the Macbeth film adaptation, which was a really good
one. Oh, that's with Kenneth Branagh. Was that the new one?
The new one was also with Fassbender as Macbeth. Oh, right. And it was... it was a really good film, and then they went and did Assassin's Creed together, and maybe they don't want to work together anymore. But yeah, that's not the first Ubisoft game that's managed to be trashed by a film. Prince of Persia was a abomination.
You know, it was a movie. I'd say
I've never quite managed to get over the fact that they got an American to do a British accent while playing a Prince of Persia.
What? Like, I don't understand the logic behind that. Like, do they think that everyone in the oldie world speaks with a, oh, yes, we should all go and save the day with our English accents in the old countryside, shall we? It's dumb. People are dumb.
Yeah. Because it's a forced accent. Because it's an American.
How everyone talked in the old days. Back in the old days when everyone was British.
Hashtag colonialism. Oh, that's... There we go. That's the first political joke of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just weird. Like, if he had an American accent, it would make sense because, you know, he is American, so they just didn't bother doing an accent. But they actually...
They asked him. They gave the time and effort to be like, hey, can you do it in, like, an English accent, please?
It just makes no sense. It wasn't the only thing that didn't make any sense in that film. Yeah, it was a thing that stands out the most, that's for sure. Terrible film. So Ubisoft is...
seen it, so...
Yeah, don't watch it. It's really disappointing. And again, I say that as a big fan of Prince of Persia, who was actually looking forward to the film, because there aren't enough films that even bother going to that location in the world, let alone doing the whole fantasy thing. It had all the potential in the world to be, but it didn't. So, tragedy. Tragedy. But there are good film adaptations.
That's arguable. There are good
Silent Hill, the original Silent Hill, was a really good film.
No, I will actually agree with you. That did a good job. It brought in a bunch of stuff that didn't make sense within Silent Hill 1, but like it was fine.
I actually hadn't played the original Silent Hill before watching the film. I've since remedied that, but the film made sense to me, and I thought they captured the atmosphere of Silent Hill perfectly in that film. Like, it was visually an amazing film, and the actors did a decent enough job and all that stuff. So,
No, it was
a really good one.
I think the most impressive thing is they completely redid the opening shots of the game, like with the same camera angles, and it just looks incredible. Like, it's a very, very striking film, like visually.
Yeah. Have you seen that one, Matt?
I've not.
It's worth it. Definitely go it's and actually that one. Worth it.
Yeah.
Don't see Revelations 3D. Do not see Revelations 3D. It's the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. It's horrendous.
Which is that one?
It's the sequel.
I'm trying to think what the last game movie I've seen is. I think it was might have been like the first Tomb Raider.
Oh, like the Angelina Jolie.
So that's going back quite a ways, and
that movie is just really dumb fun. I'm okay with it. It's fine.
It's really dumb fun. That one was on. Yeah, the Tomb Raider games back then were also kind of really dumb fun. So
I thought that one did a good job of capturing the game. Like, it was what the game was. So yeah, good on them. The new Tomb Raider looks all right.
Except for her neck. I'm kind of keen. Which they obviously photoshopped.
Yeah.
That is one of the most baffling things I've ever seen, to be quite honest. I don't understand who thought, you know what? She needs like a giraffe neck, but is then just a regular human being in the movie. It's dumb. Can we also talk about the best non-video game, but also video game film, which was made by Edgar Wright, and it was Scott Pilgrim. Because that movie is very lovely. And it's, as far as I'm concerned, it is a official video game movie, but it just doesn't have, you know, a specific license to it. It's very, very pleasant.
Well, the King Arthur film that Guy Ritchie did was basically a video game series of cutscenes without the gameplay. It was basically a video game. Well, this one was just so obviously it wanted to be a video game. It's like Guy Ritchie played like an action game of some kind and then decided, well, you know what? I'm going to turn King Arthur into that, and that's what King Arthur ended up being. I liked it against all things, all odds, I think.
I really don't hate Guy Ritchie as a director. I feel like he would do a video game movie well if he was given the time or if he had any interest in ever doing it.
Yeah.
Well, I think
if he was given the right game as well, I think.
Well, I
don't know what that would be, but
the thing that really frustrates me is that people are always like, oh, I can't wait to see a Shadow of the Colossus movie. And it's like, why?
It's perfect as is.
Don't. Like, it's so strange to me that people just want that as a movie and not, like, I don't know, something that would make more sense as a movie.
That's the thing, I guess. Why video game movies struggle. It's because they need to be true to the game enough that people who like the game are still interested, but at the same time, they can't do what the game does either. So, you know, it's a real struggle to capture the essence of the game and take out the interactivity and then still make it a quality story and stuff, because a lot of the games out there kind of rely on the interactivity to be good. Mm. Like, to go back to Assassin's Creed, I mean, if you took out the open world and the exploration and the stealth sections and all that kind of stuff, you're left with a bunch of cutscenes, and the game isn't nearly up to the storytelling of the game isn't nearly up to the standards of a really good Hollywood film or film. So to try and turn that into a film by itself is difficult. And I don't think there are many examples out there of people doing a good job. We mentioned Silent Hill. I thought the original Resident Evil did a decent job of it.
Yeah, it's campy, it's ridiculous, and it's fun. It's a fine movie.
It was true to the games without being slavishly kind of trying to copy
held back by the games.
Yeah. So I thought it was decent. The other Resident Evil films just went stupid after that. But the first one worked. Aliens versus Predator
is bad.
This is a blasphemy to say it because I'm a fan of Aliens and Predator, and nobody who likes both of those series is meant to like Aliens versus Predator. But I actually kind of like the first one. It's watchable, you know. It's watchable. It's not a great film, but it's watchable, and it's enjoyable enough. I'm trying to think.
I don't think I agree.
Watchable seems like a really low bar.
Yeah,
it is.
I could put it on, and it doesn't make me want to gouge my eyes out. It's all right.
It's a step beyond Prince of Persia and Assassin's Creed. That's fair enough. The one that I really liked, and it's only in Japanese, unfortunately. I don't think it was ever even kind Phoenix of brought out west. No, although that's okay. I think that one did have a subtitled version produced. No, I'm talking about Project Zero. The Project Zero film is actually...
Oh, that exists.
Yep. I think it was only ever... I've only watched it in Japanese. I watched it in the cinema, actually, while I was in Japan. And, it's good. It's really enjoyable and captures the atmosphere of Project Zero pretty damn well. So,
cool.
That one.
I feel like horror...
If that ever gets out in English, definitely watch it.
I feel like horror games have a much better chance of actually not being trash because they can always rely on standard horror technique. Like,
yeah, it's true.
You can make it relatively. Yeah. You can make an interesting horror movie fairly, I'm not going to say easy, but easily compared to, you know, making a compelling action movie from a game. Just because, like, when a game is so orientated around, like, the gameplay aspects, like, I've always found it so much more boring to watch someone else do something like that in a movie where I have no input on it or can't, like, comment on it or anything like that. Just because
I think it's probably also a budget thing. Like, horror films are made on lower budgets, but when you start getting into kind of action blockbusters like Assassin's Creed or whatever, you're looking at much bigger budgets. So it becomes harder to stay true to, I guess, the message. You can lose creative control of the films much easier when you're looking at very big budgeted stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen a video game movie that has not made me upset that wasn't like Silent Hill, which is bizarre. Because you'd think that there would be one, that there has to be one somewhere, and that UA Boll isn't ruining all the movies in the world.
I actually have managed to block a lot of those out. I actually watched Alone
in the Name of the King. In the Name of the King, a Dungeon Siege story. Oh, dear Lord.
What about?
I actually thought Uwe Boll did Warcraft.
That's David Bowie's son. And it's actually, I take that back. I liked that movie, but I liked it with the pretense that I like the game story. So it was just nice to see that story told again. That's legitimately
it. Yeah, it was an eye gouging film for me, that one. That was.
I thought it was
awful.
I went back, and as soon as I left the cinema, I went back and installed World of Warcraft. So I think they got me. They fucking got me.
I feel sorry. It was the plan all along.
Blizzard.
I feel sorry. Poor David Bowie. His whole legacy has just been ruined by his son making that film.
His son also made Moon. So like.
Oh, that's right. And Moon's good. Yeah.
Moon is like one of my favorite movies. I haven't seen Moon. I think it's on Netflix soon, so you can totally go watch it and be like, wow, this is really, really good. It's the new Sexy Brutale for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, let's make a movie about that. There should be more films based on indie stuff, actually. That'd be a good
idea. Would love to see a short film like based on any indie game, I think, except for like a puzzle game. Because I feel like, the Tetris movie's coming out.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, and there's a new Mario film on the way as well.
That's gonna
because the first film works. The first film works so well, they really needed to reboot the Mario film franchise.
The most distressing thing about this whole concept is the fact that it's made by Illumination, which means there's going to be a minion in it at some point. And I don't want that. That's the last thing.
Look
I
on
want,
the bright
I
side. At least they still haven't put it around. At least it's only Mario, and they're not also doing like Zelda and Donkey Kong films and like turning it into a whole Nintendo makes films.
Interesting thing. Choices.
Yeah.
Nintendo makes conceivably bad choices when it comes to multimedia.
I mean, Nintendo basically owns Bayonetta now, so they could make a Bayonetta film.
The anime was actually quite good.
It was not. The animated film.
It was good.
It was not.
The anime film was good. Not. The anime film was good. It was good. It was good.
This is kind of breaking our rules. But there was also a Devil May Cry anime, and it sucked. It was one of the worst things I've ever seen. And I'm continually impressed how they managed to make a character like Dante seem lame.
You know one that could work? Is Persona. Persona film would be...
There is. Workable. Persona 3 has two films.
Aren't there like 800 different Persona animes?
Yeah, it's Persona 4, Persona animes. 4, the Golden. Persona
well, there's 5 also coming a, out. There's also a theater production in Japan on Persona 4. It was a theater version.
You know, there's also a there's a stage play for Nier.
One or the other.
There's several stage plays for Nier, rather.
Yeah.
Because Yoko Taro is insane and hates people having, you know, all the information to understand his games.
I think there's a stage play of Hakuoki at some point.
It would make sense,
realistic thing
as a stage play more than Nier would.
Because Nier, have you seen clips of the Nier one? Because it's just a bunch of girls running around going beep 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 beep.
Of course it is. It's
very strange.
Alan, it's transgressive theatre. That's what Yoko Taro would want.
It's also and on that note, insane. But that's okay.
We'll go to some music. Monster Hunter. I'm sure there'll be a Monster Hunter film at some stage too, which would be a travesty.
Think there
but
is.
Anyway, Monster Hunter.
It's in production, I think.
Jesus. Oh boy. Okay. So Monster Hunter, look forward to the film, I guess, because the Street Fighter films and every other film that Capcom's been involved with has been a masterpiece. And look forward to the Monster Hunter film with some Monster Hunter music.
For you, the day Bison graced your presence was the best day of your life. But for me, it was Tuesday.
And welcome back, everybody. Okay, so given that we were talking about games to films, I thought we could talk about something else of a similar tangent, I guess. We're going to talk about books to games, because there aren't that many attempts to take an existing book and then spin it into a video game, which is a little bit surprising to me. Back in the day, it wasn't really, because books are obviously those big, chunky, lots of wordy things, and video games from yesteryear tended to tell stories without so many words. So it would have been hard to take a book and actually translate it into a video game. But I would have thought the last generation, especially, we would have seen more of it emerge, and we haven't really, which is fascinating to me. I haven't really thought about it enough to figure out why that might be the case. But anyway, it's an observation. But one I think that is probably up there with the most famous examples of a book that was definitely turned into a video game is Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six, and it was definitely turned into a video game.
Rainbow Six Siege is now the best thing ever made. I'm actually kind of not kidding. Play it if you haven't.
Yeah,
I realize that this is not the target audience.
Siege isn't actually based on... Siege just uses the name. It's not based on the book. But I'm talking about the actual original Rainbow Six was based on the book. And in fairness, I guess, to the developers, they did a good job of doing that. Unfortunately for the developers, they were working with some really shocking material. That book is terrible. Mm. It's dismal. It's a load of trash.
So in other words, it's Matt's favorite book.
Is Tom Clancy still around? No? He's not.
Died. I'm pretty sure he died like a year ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So whatever layer of hell he's burning in, he belongs there. Inflicting the world with the kind of trash that he wrote. No, the thing was, back in the day, I was more partial to shooters and stuff than I am these days. So I played Rainbow Six. I enjoyed it enough.
Six One's pretty good.
Yeah, I enjoyed it enough. And on that basis, I figured I'd read the book and see how it was done. And I started reading the book, and the urge to burn things rose pretty rapidly. It's a very long book too.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that's like 500 pages or something, isn't it?
For something that says absolutely nothing of worth, it's an awful lot of words. And
wow.
It was a bad first experience. Maybe that's why we don't see too many developers try and take books and turn them into games, because none of them read books that are worth turning into games.
Could we count Alan Wake as a book to game?
Was it a book first? No,
but it's like basically just a Stephen King book. Like, he references Stephen King so much in that entire game that I would consider it a book game.
Well, on that note, I mean, there's other stuff like Eternal Darkness is obviously through and through. Yeah, through and through Lovecraft. It was obviously built by people who really knew Lovecraft's unique.
Would you say that they loved it?
And stuff?
Would you say that they loved it, Matt?
Well, I think so.
jokes.
Lovecraft is Lovecraft's a very unique kind of horror, and it's difficult. It's notoriously difficult, actually, to turn into films and books and into films and other books by other writers and games and stuff. And Eternal Darkness is a good example of it. Call of Cthulhu, Dark Corners of the Earth, absolutely did it brilliantly, because it actually was a direct translation of one of the Lovecraft stories for at least the first half. The second half goes to crap because it's no longer based on a Lovecraft story, but the first half is just nails it. So those are good examples.
Yeah.
Have been approximately 50,000 attempts to make Lovecraft games of various forms.
Bloodborne.
Yes.
Yay.
And it's really hard because, like,
I don't know why I made it sound like I was a 4-year-old child there, but yay.
Yeah. Everybody wants to do Lovecraft, but it's actually really hard because it's. The thing about Lovecraft was his writing was you're never meant to get a proper picture of the monster that he was describing. The whole point of it was the monster was so far beyond time and space and comprehension that just viewing it would send you crazy because it was impossible. And how do you translate that into a film or a game or something where you obviously need to see the monster? It's really difficult. And I think a lot of artists, not just in games, but films as well, have really struggled to do that. So,
well, I mean, you have to make it visual so that people can be like, oh, that's what that is. You can't just have, like, this is Cthulhu. Enjoy.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really hard to do contextually. It's very strange.
It is. And it's fascinating that so many developers try and use Lovecraft as source material when he's probably the hardest horror writer of all to translate. But, you know, game developers like a challenge, I guess. I mean, the other obvious book that we haven't mentioned is Romance of the Three Kingdoms. I think that one's been...
It's done quite a lot.
Yeah, the source of inspiration for more than a few game developers, or pretty much the entire Colin.
I mean, also, I think we can all talk about the best, you know, book to game series, Game of Thrones, with their incredible game, Game of Thrones, the official video game.
Was that based on the film or the book, though?
I'm pretty sure.
Sorry, not the film, the TV series.
I think it's based on both, but it's one of the worst things I've ever played in my life. It's a really bad, really bad Dragon Age ripoff. But if you pick, like, a ranged character, you don't fight at range. You run up to people and start, like, pewing them in the face with your bow. It's just incredible. Yeah, like, someone made this and was like, yes.
that's one of the few RPGs I didn't play on the PS3.
You're missing out so much, Matt. It's so interesting. Things happen.
Well, there was also a strategy game that was made based on Game of Thrones as well.
Was there? Which
I think.
Is it called Final Fantasy Tactics, War of the Lions? Because that's pretty much it.
No. Like, it was a hardcore kind of real-time strategy game thing. And
like,
came before the RPG, I think. Yeah, I think so.
That'd be cool.
Only with deception and stuff thrown in. So
yeah, I'm into that. That'd be
if
cool.
It worked well. I don't think it worked very well, unfortunately. No. But speaking of strategy games based on books that did work well, Lord of the Rings...
Yeah, Lord of the Rings games have been consistently not bad.
Well, it depends. Like, if it's Warner Brothers that made it, it's terrible, generally.
The EA period of, like, the early 2000s was pretty strong in terms of actually making good tie-ins.
Yeah, EA did a great job, and I'm. Yeah, no, I agree. That was when EA was probably at its best with a licensed property. It might have ruined Star Wars, but it did a really good job with Lord of the Rings. And the Battle for Middle Earth games, the two of them were the highlights, I thought. They were really, really good. Very good strategy games, very true to the Lord of the Rings franchise and all that.
Did you ever play Conquest?
Which is a little bit off topic.
Like Lord of the Rings Conquest, because it was all right. It was like a sort of action button masher sort of thing. It was fine. It was a fine video game, but it was just not anything else. Which is sad.
No, I did not.
Also, I don't understand what this new fascination is with making expanded universe stuff with books based on games. Because they're often almost universally terrible and just like boring and badly written. It's like
that's been around forever.
It's terrible.
I remember when I was a kid buying one of the Super Mario Brothers Choose Your Own Adventure games.
Okay, no, that's horrible. That's actually
really I loved it because I was young enough to still love everything. Doesn't matter how bad it was, as long as it was in my favorite franchise, and I really loved Mario as a kid. I remember that. I don't know where that book went. I think I was very sad when. I think we moved and I couldn't find the book anymore. And it was the worst day of my life. But
jeez, I'm sorry, Matt. Are you okay?
But yeah, I agree with you. It's weird. I'm surprised that Ubisoft hasn't decided to go publish a whole bunch of books based on the
Assassin's Creed. They have. Walk into any shop right now and you will absolutely find like the dusty gross section that is just video game books. And it's like 1,000 Assassin's Creed books, like 17 Halo books, then like a Mass Effect book that was the prequel to Andromeda that no one cares about because it's the prequel to Andromeda.
Yeah, I'm not sure about doing that. It's bad. I'm assuming they're all in the youth fiction section, not the literature section.
They're not good.
They're in the bad section. They're in the bad books. Section. Don't buy this book section.
They're in the section that you go to when you're just like, why am I here? Like you're looking for something to do, but you're not really wanting to spend any money. So you just go there to take a look at what's there and then laugh and be like, haha, I'm not buying you.
Yeah. There is one. This is going back to the PlayStation 2 era. So that was ages and ages ago now. There was a series of books based on the Dungeons & Dragons Forgotten Realm setting.
But that's just D&D.
By R.A. Salvatore, the Drizzt Do'Urden novels. And back on the PS2, they made an action RPG thing, which actually
had... Was it Dragons of
No.
Oh, that was EverQuest. Sorry, my bad.
No, it wasn't that. I actually can't remember the name of it now, but there was one level in the game where you actually got to play as Drizzt Do'Urden, and the rest of the game was but you'd actually play it because that one level was really good because Drizzt Do'Urden is such a legend, and people who like Dungeons & Dragons generally like that character because the books are pretty well written. And it's really surprising to me that nobody's twinged to the idea that, hey, maybe people would like to play a Drizzt Do'Urden game. But then Dungeons & Dragons license belongs to Atari and Atari can't do crap. So that's probably the reason.
They can do things. What are you talking about? They made a great game in Alone in the Dark Illumination.
Yeah.
It was the best
Atari game. I think of all the things Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro have done, giving the Dungeons & Dragons license to Atari was the biggest mistake of all, because they've really let the whole D&D license in the video game world go to nothing, when they could have given it to a developer publisher that would have done the franchise justice and understood it, and Atari don't.
I think Atari know what they're doing to begin with. I think Atari is just sort of like, give us licenses and we'll like make a thing. We'll do it. I'll show you. It's like the annoying younger cousin.
The other big fantasy board gamey thing, company Games Workshop did a similar mistake in giving THQ license for Warhammer, and that was a mistake. But they've since remedied it since THQ went under.
That's post
THQ. Vermintide's all right.
Warrior.
Total War. What?
Tau Fire Warrior on the PS2 is one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life. You play as, like, you know, the worst race in 40K, the Tau. You play as one of their generic unit dudes and you just go and shoot people. It's really bad.
Yeah,
THU, like, concerningly bad.
Yeah, THU didn't much understand the Warhammer franchise. But yeah, nowadays it's better because everybody who wants to make a Warhammer game basically can, so everybody does.
Mm.
And that's a good thing. Warhammer was a good one. Anyway, on that note, we'll go to some music again. We've picked a track from Final Fantasy Type Zero this week because I really like Final Fantasy Type Zero, so suck it. It's actually the theme song from the game, which was performed by a Japanese group called Bump of Chicken, which is a really weird name, but a really good group. And yeah, this is the opening track. Welcome back, everybody. For the last section of the podcast this week, we're going to do our in-depth with the game, and we decided to go back a bit through the catalogue of Final Fantasy this week to talk about Final Fantasy X, which is a game that all three of us really enjoy for one reason or another, and that's a good thing. And it's also, I want to say, it's probably one of the more intelligent Final Fantasies that has been produced, and that's not to say the other ones in the series are not, but I think the themes and the way that Final Fantasy X deals with them was pretty good even for the time, and still holds up very strongly today in terms of depth,
I'd say.
Yeah, very deep and very serious themes, and still relevant, obviously, today. And yeah, it's really good. I mean, the obvious thing that kind of really stands out to you is that the way the game kind of treats with religion and stuff, and it's got a lot to say about religion, and versus with kind of the orthodoxy of churches versus people's individual faith, and how that kind of plays out. And yeah, it's It's a complex discussion.
Really, really clever game, and that's surprising from a PS2 launch title. Wait, was it a launch title?
I don't think it was.
Oh, it was very, very. It was like 2001, which, yeah. As far as I'm concerned, anything before 2001 is a PS2 launch title. Just because, yeah. It came out at a time for me when I had just gotten my PS2, and I was very, very excited. And very, very into it as a concept. But I didn't really understand what was happening at the time. So, you know, I got maybe halfway through, got to see on Seymour Flux, I think, is the zombie boy. Yeah, that fight sucks. And I just never beat it. And I quit the game from then on and then played it again, I want to say, when I was 15. And just loved it and loved every single thing about it because it was just so different to anything that you would expect from a game where you go around and like summon things and beat people up. Yuna's actually evil is what I'm trying to say. For a game that, you know, you go into it and it looks so happy and so positive the entire way through, and then you get to that scene where you see the first sending and it's just incredibly sad and upsetting, and you know, you find out that the monsters that you're killing have actually just been the souls of people who have died because of sin and are incredibly upset about that. Like, it's cool because it makes you feel like, well, I'm just killing people who've been killed already. They don't really deserve it, to be quite honest. The thing that's
interesting is that the discussion the game has about the role of religion in society as you play it is really fascinating, because some of the time it's obviously critical of the way that, you know, religion is handled, and especially the orthodoxy, it's quite critical of the orthodoxy. Mm. But at the same time, it continually reinforces the value of religion in society and the role that spirituality has for people in terms of giving them peace or giving them purpose and all of that kind of stuff. So it has that really complex discussion without... It doesn't judge necessarily. I mean, it doesn't judge at all, but it has that conversation about both the merits and the ways that religion can be used in a negative way in society. And that was really fascinating for me back then. I mean, games didn't generally... Games
and religion were separate.
No. Yeah. They
were often very, very separate.
Even today, like games that try and address a difficult topic, they usually get so very high and kind of moralizing about them, and they take a stance and then they just drive that stance home, and there's kind of no room for discussion within the game itself. You can agree with it when you're playing it, or you can disagree with it. But within Final Fantasy X, and what makes it so relevant, I think, in terms of how game storytelling works today, is that the discussion's actually there within the game, and it tries to take on various different angles and provide you with different perspectives, and doesn't come to a judgment that it leaves up to you, but it gives you all the information that you need to have a proper complex discussion within the story itself. And that's where the game for me is so far ahead of its time, and still, you know, holds up today, like I said.
Yeah, I love the fact that Yevon is not a religion. It's like, oh, it's just Christianity, but it's a combination of almost every single modern religion into one being, but then with this like crazy super demon thing that they like, please don't kill us. It just feels like a coherent mesh of an actual thing that could happen in this world, and I just really enjoy it. I think it's absolutely wonderful to watch, you know, because Tidus is obviously new to the world as well at this point in time in the game, learning along with him, like, what are the customs here, why are they the way they are, is so, so interesting. And that's, I'm going to go on a little bit of a tangent here to Final Fantasy 13. I think 13 has a lot of stuff going for it, but you need to know so much going into it that it's almost impenetrable to anyone who doesn't know what's happening. I think 10 does a very, very good job of introducing you in a, you know, well-paced manner throughout the entire game to, you know, what Yevon is, what Spirit is, and what, you know, Blitzball is to a certain extent as well. I just think it's very, very cool. It's a good game.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that you touched on there, I think it's interesting that there's no exact parallel between the religion that Final Fantasy X presents and any real world religion, and that's because I think it takes on elements, like you said, of all the different religions in the really real world. And I think that's kind of the point. It's showing that there's commonality between religions in our world, and those commonalities have, you know, certain traits, and Final Fantasy X explores that as kind of the commonality in spirituality in our world, and highlights the fact that, you know, essentially religions are saying similar stuff to one another.
Yeah, it's great. It's a very just, I guess, well thought out game. And again, for a game that came out in 2001, it didn't happen. That was not a thing that existed at all at that point in time. So, and I feel like it's very, very cool to have it.
Yeah, there just weren't that many games that had that kind of nuance and complexity to them. I mean, there were some. Ico was around the same time, and it's a very complex game. Persona 3 was kicking around then as well.
No, Persona 3 was 2004, I believe.
Well, close enough. It would have been in development at the same time Final Fantasy X was, so, or at least it would have been in concept. So, yeah, there were some games that were kicking around. But, yeah, Final Fantasy X was certainly a step beyond the very simple moralizing that a lot of games threw at you.
It doesn't, you know, it was also just a very important game in general because it was the first fully 3D, you know, Final Fantasy game. So having this be, you know, on the PS2 in 2001 and seeing what are quite, you know, visually striking things. Like, it's a very beautiful game even to this day. If you haven't played it, I recommend picking up the HD collection if you can, because it looks gorgeous and it's still really fun. It opened, you know, a discussion to people who probably wouldn't have had that discussion before because it was such a mainstream game at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of the technical development of the game, we've got a lot to thank for Final Fantasy X. It certainly drove a lot of the future direction of the Final Fantasy series as well. I mean, Final Fantasy XIII's linearity, which everybody criticizes, was a direct consequence, I think, of Final Fantasy X, which was much the same. And I don't have a problem with it. I thought the combat system was very well designed and was the last properly turn-based Final Fantasy game that we've had. So,
yeah, I'd say this was the best turn-based Final Fantasy, just in terms of actually playing the game and enjoying it. I will say, yes, I love 6 a great deal. I love 4 a great deal. I love 3, but I feel like this one does it so much more more interesting because you have to use all the player characters in game, and it's such a small change to make. But the ability to swap party members on the fly is so. Just like it makes so much sense.
It kind of makes it feel like
a group.
Yeah, all of these people are journeying together. It's not just like in all the other games where you have like 10 people all apparently journeying together, but then you only ever see 3 or 4 of them in combat at once. And it's like, well, what are the other guys doing?
They're singing the same song in the background.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Square Enix has tried to deal with that in various different ways in the past. Like in Final Fantasy VI, for example, there was a big cast, but it constantly split them up so that you know, whenever you were out and about, you only had 3 of them in your actual party at that point in time, 3 or 4 of them in your party at that point in time. Final Fantasy VIII did a similar thing quite often. Oh, no, hang on. It had a lot of backup characters in the second half. The first half, it was quite good, and then it did what you said. But, yeah, it was the first time that Final Fantasy X was the first time that you had a large group traveling together, and it worked hard to make you feel like they were all participating. And that helped, I think, create a stronger connection between players and the characters in that game. It wasn't just the fact that they were the most lifelike that we'd seen in Final Fantasy to date. They were finally, you know, they finally had lips that moved, and they finally had character models that...
They had lips that moved, albeit kind of weirdly and not in a human way.
Well, that was because of the localization. They didn't read lip sync for English. But yeah, they had, you know, they had mouths that worked. They had bodies that looked basically human as opposed to a bunch of polygons as in the previous Final Fantasy games. And that all that technical step up just made, I think, people resonate a lot more strongly with the characters, which was important because the game story was obviously a very character-driven and emotional one, where it was asking you constantly to really empathize with what the characters were getting up to. And if you didn't connect with them, if you didn't constantly use them in battle, if they didn't look as good as they did, that wouldn't have happened. So that's a good example of, you know, the technology that was available to Square Enix at the time being used to take Final Fantasy to a different level and really drive the characters home. So, and that's obviously become the kind of the center point of Final Fantasy since. It's always been about the characters and the story they go through since then.
Like Jekt, my favorite hero. I'm waiting for Matt to... So this is the eternal argument in the DDNet chat, the Slack that we have, is whether or not Jekt is the worst character of all time, and I've been specifically told not to bring up this thing, but I'm going to do it anyway. I think Jekt's awesome. I know that Matt doesn't like him for a lot of reasons that are quite valid, but I just really enjoyed the entire antagonist idea of the game, where it wasn't really Tidus, you know, fighting against some greater evil. It's just Tidus, like, fighting against the fact that he had a lot of, you know, problems growing up with his dad. I think that's cool. I think it's really, really cool. Yeah, I know that we all disagree on it, but, you know.
I just found Jekt to be an anti-climatic kind of end boss. You know, the game spent so long setting up Sin as the embodiment of everything going wrong in the world, basically. And the
Its name is literally Sin.
Yeah, exactly. Its name is literally Sin. So it was meant to be the embodiment of everything that can go wrong with people. And then I understand, obviously, that Jekt is symbolic of that himself. But yeah, I just found it wasn't as potent of in battle as it kind of needed to be for something that the game spent so long building up as what I thought Sin was going to be. So I don't have a problem with the character arc or the story or whatever. I just think that he didn't work as the end bad thing, basically. Yeah, if they had swapped the order of battle so that you fought Unalesca at the end and then Jekt when you fought Unalesca, it would have made more sense to me, I think. And because Unalesca represented, you know, the religion itself, the negatives of the religion and the which for me was the main kind of point of the plot. So to have her as the end boss would have made more sense, I think, for me.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I guess I can we spoil a 17-year-old game?
Yes, we can. But anyway, I was just going to say that that's kind of the more complex way of me saying that I think Jekt sucks. But yeah. So that's where the Slack discussion comes from.
I think Jekt sucks, but he sucks in a meaningful way, and he's supposed to suck because he's just a really shit. Shitty dad, and that the whole Tidus storyline is him like coming to terms with that and dealing with that and coping with that, which I think is a very interesting angle, and again something that not a lot of games deal with or deal with well.
Yeah,
I agree with that, and I think actually part of it is probably the boss that you kind of wanted to fight at the end of the game probably depends on which one you kind of thought, which of the characters you thought was the main character. For me, Tidus was never the main character. Yeah, for me, Una was always the main character. So for me, her battle with Unalesca was more the main part of the game, whereas Tidus and Jekt was more kind of a side story. That's something I've found difficult with a couple of Final Fantasy games, actually, because Final Fantasy XII was much the same thing. Varn's meant to be the main character, but for me, the story was always about Ash.
So. Psycho.
Yeah. So the main story was kind of more about Ash's story. So again, the order in which some of these battles play out doesn't resonate with me quite as well as I think Square Enix intended it to. So I think that's part of it. I think
it's a good game. I'm really breaking out all the stops here to make a hot take. I think that Final Fantasy X is a very good game, and you can get it for like $30 now in the HD collection, and you should play it because it's good. Yeah,
it's a genuine classic. I think.
Yeah, it holds up.
Genuine classic.
It really does.
Except for Seymour. Seymour is trash.
And if you get the HD collection, you also get Final Fantasy X2, which is also brilliant and stuff.
Sure.
Otherwise known as AKB Final Fantasy.
Don't know how I feel about this.
I quite liked it. I thought, you know, after the seriousness of Final Fantasy X, to have that kind of light, kind of
goofy pop game.
Idol, yeah, pop idol focused themes and nonsense and ridiculous costume changes and fan service out the wazoo, all of that stuff kind of was a nice antidote to Final Fantasy X. So I actually think they work well together. I don't think Final Fantasy X2 works well as an independent game, but I think in the context of Final Fantasy X, there's a nice it's a nice relief to the seriousness of Final Fantasy X.
Yes, also the soundtrack's very, very good.
Also, the more games that have Riku in it, the better. We didn't talk about Riku, but she's the best character. She's not the main character. She's just the best character.
I have no words. You're so wrong.
Nah, I'm right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Yes. Well, should we wrap this up here then?
Yes, I was going to say, and on that note, we'll go to some music from a modern classic. It'll be a game that we'll probably be talking about 15, 20 years down the track as a classic. Nier Automata. This is Weight of the World, which is one of the wordy songs, and it's a really good song. So enjoy.
Thanks for
listening. Yeah, it is really good. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you at the next podcast.
叫ぶあの壊れた世界の歌そう僕らは今あの意味でも願うただ君との未来をそう僕らは今あの価値でも叫ぶこの世
Like, what's it called? Mortal Kombat. Mortal Kombat?
That was the worst film, I swear to
no,
God.
No, okay, Mortal Kombat 1 is fine. It is fine as a movie. Mortal Kombat 2 is one of the worst things that I've ever seen. Is it Deception? Is it called Deception or is it called, like, Come?
What? Oh, there's one for the blooper reel at the end.
Yeah, that's going at the end.